You are listening to our abduction special, Dr. David Jacobs.
The history of abductions goes back, we think, and this is a guess, an educated guess, but a guess, that it probably goes back to maybe the late 19th century. The first case that we knew about is in 1957 in Brazil. A young man claimed that he was abducted into a UFO. There was odd things that happened, sometimes even sexual in nature. He duly reported this to researchers in Brazil. It was so horribly embarrassing and so off the wall for UFO researchers who are only 10 years down the line with knowledge of the UFO phenomenon in general that the case was not published until many years later. After this case, which nobody knew about, there was the famous Barney and Betty Hill case. Barney and Betty Hill were an interracial couple who were traveling in New Hampshire on their way back from Canada to the United States, and they had a two-hour time gap on the way home, essentially, to Portsmouth, New Hampshire. Investigations a few years later found out that they had been abducted. After Barney and Betty Hill sort of came out in public and there was a book written about them in 1966, we began to get a trickle of other abduction accounts. Finally, by the late 1970s, a man by the name of Bud Hopkins began to research some sightings and other sort of events that had happened to a friend of his who lived across the street. When he published an article about this sort of series of events that had happened, which included multiple witnesses, it included occupant sightings, as they used to call them, on the ground, he began to get an enormous amount of mail from people who had similar experiences. He then took the abductees, or the people who didn't even know that they were abducted, actually, to a psychologist who knew nothing about the subject at all, and had her do hypnosis to see why it was that a lot of these people had missing time sequences. They seemed to be missing, didn't know where they were, and nobody else knew where they were or could see them. It was obvious that he was onto something much more in-depth and much more serious than I had ever imagined.
And that was a woman who remembers vividly waking up at night, and she had gray at the foot of her bed. A fairly familiar story. In fact, there was one of Bud Hopkins' subjects or people he investigated, or ever how you want to phrase it, the late, great Bud Hopkins. We have a friend of the late, great Bud Hopkins with us right now. He's walking back to his apartment where he's staying. He's been out in Tempe, Arizona for a little while. Peter Robbins, how are you?
Well, I'm fine, Jerry. A bit warm, but doing very well and glad to be back on the show.
Yeah, it's probably, what, 93, 94 degrees, something like that?
Something like that. And as they say, it's a dry heat, though.
Yeah.
You're more like in an oven than in a sauna.
Yeah, and when you get in the sun there, it eats you alive. Anyway,
amen.
Peter, say hello to Craig Lang and Elaine Douglas.
Hey, Elaine, how are you doing? And hi, Craig.
Hey, how you doing? How you doing, Peter?
What were you doing out in Tempe? Did you make some sort of lecture this weekend?
Yeah. Phoenix MUFON and Sedona MUFON invited me out to give some talks Friday and Saturday, updates on the Rendlesham case, and I tied it in with some other business and am filling my time very nicely and spending some of my days at the offices of the terrific Open Minds organization, where I've got a number of friends, and they're letting me set up my computer in an empty cubicle and get some work done and hang out with them. And my week is going quickly. Saturday I'll fly back to Ithaca and the East Coast.
Now, when we talk about Bud Hopkins, you have some firsthand experience. If you were on the air with me and you explained to me that your sister actually had an abduction story, and that's how you met Bud Hopkins. Is that right?
Well, you're absolutely right, Jerry. We go back when Bud passed last year at 80. We had just marked our 35th year as friends and colleagues. Bud and I met in 1976, which was 5 years before he published his first book, which, of course, was Missing Time, that really put him on the map. And I met him because my sister, in 1975, had first shared memories with me of her abduction-related experiences. It's very close to my sister. She didn't spin things. She was a good-hearted person. And 1975, this was not something that was, a staple of talk shows, of documentaries, of books. I didn't know anything about it. I think I had heard something about Betty and Barney Hill in a special issue of Life magazine when I was a kid, but I was just very, very upset when she told me about it. And up until that moment in my life, I had a very clear career track. I was already a graduate of the Fine Art School in the United States, the School of Visual Arts in New York. I was on their faculty. I was an aspiring young painter in New York City. Bud was more an established painter. And I was doing my best to educate myself to what had happened to my sister. And about a year into this, 1976 as it turned out, I picked up a copy of a New York weekly called The Village Voice, which hardly is a paper that one would associate with UFOs as a subject. And much to my surprise, there in the paper was an article about a remarkable case that had occurred the year before in New Jersey. And I had been doing reading a lot of it, you know, you get what you can, and this is the mid-70s, some of it pretty harebrained or lighter-than-air Welcome to Space Brothers stuff. And I was realizing there was a scientific body of work that I was beginning to connect with. I was not really keen on meeting a lot of folks who were in the field because I thought they had to be a little loopy. I knew my sister was fine and I was fine. And I read this article, and the first thing that struck me was it was particularly well-researched and very well-written. And the author was this guy named Bud Hopkins. And it mentioned in the liner note that he was a painter. And I thought, good Lord, I think I've seen his work in the galleries. And I you know, maybe it wasn't the most polite thing to do, but in early 1976, after I read the article, I simply cracked the giant New York City phone book. There was one Bud Hopkins in the phone book. And I cold called him, and I introduced myself as a fellow painter who was interested in UFO studies and whose sister seems to have had an experience, and I wondered if I could chat with him. And he asked me a few questions, ironically, more about what my artwork was like than anything else. And he invited me to come over and have coffee. And, of course, we have no way of knowing in life when things are taking a major turn. And a few days later, I showed up at his door of his kind of funky townhouse on... sorry about that background noise. I'm very close to the Phoenix airport.
Oh, that's fine.
And he invited me in. He was smart. He was sharp. I loved his house. It was filled with art and books and just radiated intelligence and interest. And we started a friendship then. And on and off over the next years, usually every couple of months, we'd get together, talk, have coffee, talk about art and UFOs. And then 5 years later, he finished this extraordinary study, establishing him as the true pioneer of UFO abduction studies. And his life began to change very dramatically. He went from Bud Hopkins, professional painter and family man and intellectual, to the Bud Hopkins that we now look back on as the pioneering UFO abduction investigator who's known worldwide. And within a short time, he was starting to get mail from people from all over the country, then around the world, and he needed an assistant. I was living most of my life kind of out of the box, and I started to volunteer a few days a week. And on and off over the next 20-odd years, I worked by his side through several hundred abduction cases. I was in an extraordinarily privileged position and have considered myself very fortunate that I've had the vantage that I've had to look at this from literally right over his shoulder. I'm one of those people who does not have the luxury of disbelief, Jerry. And that's one of the reasons why I have to keep my critical facility sharp and my skepticism sharp. And to go off on a 60-second tangent, I think in the field, a lot of good colleagues, because they know it's real, they've seen the preponderance of the evidence, they just go right into the next investigation, assuming this is probably what it is. Where I basically force myself to begin right at the bottom again and work my way up. And as maybe you've discussed a bit or will be discussing, we're not just talking about people who allege that they've had these extraordinary experiences. There is an associated battery of physical proofs and multiple witnesses and in many cases truly anomalous health histories and missing pregnancies, implants, scarification that happens overnight, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I not only got to spend time with these people, handle these proofs, but many of them said, you know, talk to my family. Here's the contact information for my obstetrician or my psychologist, my therapist. And so it went. I witnessed more hypnotic regressions than I can remember. I was an adjunct, so to say, when Bud started support groups. I was there, and often the only person that had not been through this. My dear sister benefited very much from her time working with Bud and facing her concerns and fears and confusions, and that solidarity of being with other people who had the same experiences and realizing, good Lord, this is just what happened to me. So, again, I consider myself extremely, extremely lucky, if that's the word, for getting caught up in this madness. And I, you know, I can question individual cases, but the phenomenon for me, it is not something visionary or fictitious, to paraphrase General Twining's in his famous September 1947. But a genuine phenomenon.
Before we go any further, Craig and Elaine and I were discussing bloodlines and whether or not these things go in families.
Yes.
So I have to ask you, Peter, and I never have.
Yes.
Have you had an abduction experience? Your sister did.
That's a great question, and it makes all the sense in the world. No is the short answer. How do I know that with some certainty? I have put myself in a position where I have been regressed three different times by three different hypnotists, including Bud, including one of my other mentors, a tough, no-nonsense New York City police detective who was a crack UFO investigator, Pete Mazzola, who too few people in the field know about. He died much too young, but who, along with Bud and the late Coleman von Kavetsky, all taught me to investigate this phenomena without any mystical fanfare, but more like law enforcement looks into felonies and criminal activity. And the other reason that I am convinced that nothing happened to me is because there are instances when a sibling, a husband or wife, parents are literally shut off when the other person is taken. And
yeah,
I requested all my hypnotists to ask me as many probing questions as possible. Among the sort of list of a priorities that Bud and people like John Mack and Dave Jacobs and other pioneering investigators put together was a rather quirky list of extreme phobias of, you know, as a child going missing and being found later, in a different location, but with a perfect little corduroy scoop mark on your knee and no blood on your pants or what have you. Very strange, unusual fears. If you're a woman, the fact that you seem to be pregnant and then all of a sudden you weren't pregnant, missing fetus syndrome, and on and on and on. And I thought, you know, here I am working for 20 years with these people, and I'm saying this from the heart, and if anybody does voice stress analysis and they're recording this, you can actually do voice stress analysis, VSA technology, from a first-generation recording. Check me out. But nothing has rattled loose in the last 37 years, so I'm going to guess that that's really the case. However, to address this bloodline thing, when we, the UFO research community, really began to look at this, a small core of people like Bud, in earnest, in the 70s, the logical mind suggested that if such things happened, it was probably about the same odds as, you know, winning a $10 million lottery and getting hit by lightning. If you're picked up by these other intelligences, it's a fluke. You know, they grab you, they examine you, they let you go. What, of course, we now know, based on hundreds and hundreds of careful case studies, is it's just the opposite. If it happened to you once, it has probably happened to you on and off throughout your life, beginning when you were very young, and it probably happened to one of your parents and to one of their parents, and so on and so on. This is chilling. It sounds absolutely wild to people that have not studied the literature or have an appreciation of what we're talking about. It's simply the way it is.
Craig and Elaine, feel free to jump in here with any conversation or any questions you want to ask.
I have a bunch of them, but I don't think we've ever met, Peter. Craig Lang. I don't know if you. I know I met Bud a number of times. I really miss him. He was cool. I love him.
Yeah.
Has your family had other histories of experiences?
Well, of course, that's a great question. When Helen and I first discussed this in 1975, it took me some months to really wrap my head around it and to begin to educate myself. And we waited about a year or two until we sat down with Mom and Dad. And this was all triggered by a phenomenal memory from childhood that had simply been repressed until it emerged for a number of reasons. I could go into why I think they happened. My memory phenomenal daylight sighting that we had together as kids on the front lawn of the house we grew up in a village on Long Island, New York, about 30 miles from Manhattan. And when we finally sat down with Mom and Dad, they were really taken aback, quite shaken up, but they didn't call us liars or anything. We were good kids and we were good adults. And I started to show my mom and dad some of the literature that was beginning to come up, and just they weren't really comfortable with it, but my dad more so than my mom. In fact, he started to read the books. There was, I remember one wonderful day where he came to work with me and spent the day with Bud and me in Bud's studio, asking questions, you know, looking at stuff. He liked Bud very much. So did my mom, who also met him. But my mom was always more reticent. And I consider myself a good investigator, but boy, oh boy, I had a moment in my life, I guess this has to be about 15 years ago. It may seem, you know, to you guys, well, you should have asked your parents right off the bat if they thought they had anything like this. It was just kind of an awkward thing to ask our mom and dad this. And I had other things on my mind. But a few years before my mom died, she was a first-generation Russian Jewish immigrant and an extraordinary woman, extremely intelligent, very vivacious at some times, very kind of reflected at others. And we were having a vodka together, and she said, you know, when Helen first talked about this, it was very unnerving for me. But having read some of the material, I now appreciate that such things happen. And I've met some of your friends that, you know, also have had it happen. I haven't read the books. They make me a bit anxious, to be honest with you. But I've gone through them. I've seen some of the television shows. And I wanted to share something with you. I said, what's that, Mom? She said, I think it may have happened to me. And I think I kept a straight face, but inside I froze. It just, you know, call it evasion of the obvious, but it was overwhelming to me that this could have happened to my mother. Of course, it's the most logical thing in the world, in a sense. And I said, oh, yeah, whatever. And she said, yeah, I have this indentation in my back that I didn't have at a certain point when I was a kid. And then all of a sudden, one of my sisters noticed, and you want to take a look at it. And I said something like, oh, well, maybe another time. And I just freaked. I couldn't handle, you know, yeah, Mom, sure, I want to look at your alien abduction scar, if that's what it is. And a few years later, she was gone, and that opportunity passed. So that's the long answer to your short question. It does seem,
yeah,
I can only deduce that that is a strong possibility on my mom's side of the family.
Were
yes.
Were there other unusual things in the family line, too, like psychic experiences, shamanic, or like I hear a lot where it seems to go down the maternal family line, too, is what I've noticed. You know, it's a lot of times the husbands or brothers will be unaffected, kind of like you're describing. But the it's where, you know, they'll describe mom was a psychic, grandma was a healer back in the old country, and, you know, my daughter is like
yeah,
an
sure.
indigo child, things like that.
But to be honest with you, not really. If there was,
okay.
I missed it. My sister was always very intuitive. She, like me, chose to kind of follow a different path in life. I began my life as a painter and became a writer. I worked in the theater for many years, off-Broadway theater management of a repertory company. And I've always considered myself something of an outsider. Helen, maybe even more so. She was a poet who became a fairly well-known rock and roll singer in New York, who really lived life on her own terms, very outspoken, didn't really care what people thought of what she maintained had happened to her. So her role in life ultimately, in part, as an educator and somebody to just be an example of, yeah, this stuff happens, it happened to me, and I've got my dreams and my life and my friends, and, you know, I don't let it run my life. But no, I guess the closest I could say is my mother's mother, my Nana, was she came over from Russia, and she was basically an illiterate person in terms of writing, but she was about the smartest person I knew in terms of practical things. She was a marvelous cook. She was a great storyteller. She was the one most in touch with her emotions. But other than that, no. And again, it's not something I explored with my mom's mom or her sisters and things. Mm-hmm. It just wouldn't have occurred to me in a funny way. Again, call it evasion of the obvious. This is my family.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, right. let me jump in here for a minute. Elaine, Peter brought something up with Craig that I thought was pretty important. And I've noticed this with over the years of people I've interviewed, and Peter and Craig, you can comment as well.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that many of these abductees are creative, artistic.
Mm-hmm.
Haven't you noticed
that? Well,
many
of them are. Many of them are. But having, again, sat through more support group meetings than I can remember, meeting with tremendous numbers of them simply by being in the office. And when I say several hundred, I'm not spinning numbers, easily several hundred over 20 years, but I think worked closely with close to 1,000 people over the years, you know, maybe it's 900 or something, and many of them were not very creative. You know, they were doctors, lawyers,
yeah, in other words, it's kind of the gambit which we talked earlier, where a fellow who's a janitor called
across the board, Jerry, every profession, character type, socioeconomic background, race, religion, predisposition, sexual preference, you name it. And being in New York City, in a way, maybe we had a more compelling demographic because everybody and their mother and brother is represented in New York City. It wasn't like doing the same kind of studies in Kansas City or in Keokuk, Iowa, or
wherever.
Well, you know, anywhere else, exactly. So we had a remarkable, rich group of people because they happened to be in New York, because they happened to find Bud one way or the other, and begin to work with them and attend support group meetings or come by the office. Again, many of them did one hypnotic regression. Some did none. Many did quite a number. And one of my many office jobs was to label these tapes. If requested, make a copy for the individual, which I think was often the case. Log them in, you know, very analog system and a big old-fashioned ledger in box after box after box, and maintain the files, some of which contain Bud's notes, others transcriptions of tapes, others, when we were allowed and given permission, medical records or communications from their therapist or what have you, sometimes CAT scans, x-rays, when it involved implants, which came up, you know, not every day, but it certainly was a thread that worked its way through it, and that is certainly physical evidence to see an anomalous object subcutaneously under the skin without a scar, and every once in a while in a place that not only it shouldn't be, but that it couldn't be. My most dramatic one I'm remembering was a first-generation big old x-ray, and right there in somebody's skull, let's say an inch and a half down and 2 inches in slightly to the right or whatever, was something that just registered as a hard, regular shape. There was no question in anyone's mind, medical or lay, that it had no business being there. And these things were usually round like a BB or elongated like a grain of rice or something.
Yeah.
Silicone-based, metallic-based, whatever, and we can only make educated guesses as to their purpose, and there aren't that many options, control, tracking, influence, what have you.
We haven't discussed implants much tonight. I'm glad you brought that up, Peter. It's pretty common with abductees that they do have some sort of markings on their body. And
yes,
if you further investigation, ends up there's an implant of some sort.
Yes, or that it's marked that doesn't have anything to do with an implant. The classic ones that, for me, are the most memorable are reminiscent of nothing more than a tiny, tiny little micro-miniature ice cream scoop, where it's sort of a perfect and a half circle. But again, there's never a period of time, ever, that we came in contact with where it scabbed over, it was just instantly cauterized. Then there were like surgical scars on some people that
looks like a punch biopsy.
Night. Yeah, woke up the next day and, you know, there's a scar, a 2-inch line in a certain part of their anatomy, and they'd be in a number of different places. And all of these were photographed, documented, logged in, and became part of our database.
You did an appearance, I think, a couple of months ago in one of Bud Hopkins' most famous patients or clients or whatever what you want to phrase it. Linda Cotillo was there. Isn't that, is my memory right? Didn't you do something with Linda Cotillo recently?
I did. A rather remarkable program of kind of ufological education is going on at a small college in western New York State, and I wish representatives from every university and college could have a window in on this. It began with a professor of anthropology, a respected man named Phil Hasley, who I have great, great admiration for, a professor of anthropology who also happens to be, and I'm not using his name out of school, it's not a secret thing or anything, he is a state section director of MUFON in western New York State. And because of his interest, this small school, which is called Niagara County Community College, and it's very close by Buffalo and actually not that much of a ride from the legendary Niagara Falls, some years back he invited a UFO speaker. I forget who the first one was, but it went over very well. The students found it fascinating. Obviously, the administration did not feel hideously embarrassed. Everybody reported that it was a most intriguing conversation, and then they hired another. I've spoken there a number of times. Travis Walton has now spoken, Bud, Leslie Kane, and Richard Dolan, and a handful of other respected researchers and investigators. First time I spoke there, they said they expected 70 people. They had close to 300. The next day, I spoke for a 70-odd person anthropology class as a guest lecturer. And what happened most recently was, I think it was March 31st, they had a panel discussion, and a very unusual one it was. It was Linda Corfield, who had not spoken in public for many years, continues to live in the same home, that apartment house in Lower Manhattan. She's lived in for many years, including during these events. A Reverend Stephen Cox, who is a state section director and who is the publisher of New York State's monthly MUFON bulletin, a great gal named Cookie Stringfield, who is the head of a very well organized meetup group coming out of Rochester, New York, where they have these terrific meetings every month with great speakers, and David Jacobs. And Dave spoke, and Linda spoke. I moderated, and then they had a discussion, and then we took questions. Well, the kicker was for me, this is a pretty rural part of New York State. It's not got a lot of money and things, and their policy is students can go for free, but folks in the community are invited for a $3 donation, which always goes to a local hospice. And I'll tell you what, my big surprise was over 500 people showed up. And the percentage of students was rather modest. The percentage of local folks was huge. And they were not there to mock or to roll their eyes or to, you know, ask stupid questions. They were there because they find this subject very compelling. I will also say from a number of visits up there that there is maybe a slightly elevated percentage of abductees, at least among the folks that I've met, and there is interest in the community, and son of a gun, it was a heck of a night. Very thoughtful, reflective, intelligent questions were asked, and this is something that, you know, in an ideal world could be going on at institutions of higher learning. I'm just thankful we have academics like Professor Phil Hasley and open-minded colleges like Niagara County Community College, and I hope that maybe somebody who's listening to me now who's affiliated with the university or college may look into this and consider hiring, you know, a respected UFO author or researcher to come and speak at their school. It's not going to embarrass them in the least. In fact, it might just add to the credibility in the big picture.
The reason I mentioned Linda is this Brooklyn Bridge UFO experience, and maybe our audience doesn't realize what happened. And I have a kind of a naive question for you, Peter, but
sure.
I'm going to ask it anyway. She floated out of that window, right, into a UFO?
Yes.
Did she ever explain exactly how that happened, or was she aware of it at the time? Did she look down and see the building? She's up in the air by herself. I mean, you know. Tell us a little bit about that.
She wasn't by herself, actually. She wasn't by herself. Linda had been having these kinds of experiences since she was very young. And part of the mythology is how come only people from Nebraska or, you know, from Keokuk or the woods claim they've had these things? Well, forget it. It happens to people in big cities, too. What made this different was that this is Lower Manhattan at 2 in the morning, and there's a lot of people up doing things, night jobs, insomniacs, coming and going from, you know, whatever. And once word of this case got out initially, several dozen people contacted Bud. I will say one of the threads that ran through every one of their accounts was, number one, I don't want money. I don't want recognition. I don't want to go on the Oprah show. I don't want to write a book. I am obsessed with what I saw. I have not been the same since. I have to know what happened. Here's my account. Here's a drawing from where I was. But Linda, Swiss-Italian, New Yorker, grew up in Little Italy, a very genuine, decent, kind woman who has been married to the same guy for decades, two grown-up sons, two grandsons, but right around Thanksgiving 1989, I was working at the studio, and she came in after having made an appointment with Bud to explore partial memories. And this is also one of the myths that hypnotherapists like Bud are evil, crazy people who think people are abducting people, and they get weak-minded folks. They hypnotize them and convince them that it's happened. The huge majority of folks
evil
that
hypnotists
approached Bud over the decades did so because they had at least partial memories of what happened, and they were coming in to make a decision whether or not they should explore them more deeply and what that implied, using hypnosis, regressive hypnosis, in part as a tool. And I watched that whole case move forward in terms of its genesis. The book witnessed the true story of the Brooklyn Bridge UFO abductions. It was published, I believe, in 1996. So that was like a five, almost six-year investigation. And that was a period of time where I worked regularly with Bud, more than any other major case. And that was one that I ate, slept, lived, and breathed on and off for quite a number of years, of course, overlapping most of my work with Larry Warren on the Rendlesham Forest English UFO case. I got to know Linda. She is still a very dear friend. And on that particular instance where the first abduction that they were really exploring came up, she woke up, and I'm working from memory here, so I hope anybody with the book who finds that I'm inaccurate will not accuse me of fabricating or anything like that. But as I recall, she levitated off her bed. There were gray beings in the room. She was in her nightgown. It's November, rather cold. And she and they float through the plate glass bedroom window of her 12th floor apartment in Lower Manhattan, obviously very close to the Brooklyn Bridge, and up into a huge glowing disc, which was seen by many people, most of whom, once they got over not believing their eyes, assumed it was some kind of extraordinary special effect and that a movie was being shot in Lower Manhattan. And for me, as an investigative writer who approaches things in a very pragmatic way, I can't tell you how exciting it was over the months when we really started to receive these accounts from people who, to the best of our knowledge, did not know each other. And again, very important, because the first thing the critical or debunking mind is going to say, well, they're in it for something. In this case, no one, and I stress again, nobody wanted assent. Nobody wanted any recognition. A number of people who came forward were so upset that they said, I'm going to give you my account, but you can't even include me in the book. And I don't know, there's like two dozen or so people, real people. Woman coming back from a friend's retirement party on the Brooklyn Bridge looks and sees what she assumes is a film being shot. Somebody down at the loading dock of one of the big New York City papers, blue collar, looks up and sees this woman in a nightgown and these three kind of curled up things floating into this huge disc. Then the story gets very complicated, but all through it, Linda remained Linda. And when Bud finally sat her down and told her that upon genuine deep investigation, that it really did seem that this had happened to her in no uncertain terms, when what she was hoping for was that he could help her establish that she was suffering from some kind of hallucinatory condition or mental aberration and refer her to the right kind of medical professional to give her some kind of prescription to make it go away, she was heartbroken. And something I was pledged not to speak to about for many years, but she has now made it public, and it was wonderful hearing her talk about it, was at the time Cardinal O'Connor, certainly one of the most powerful and best-known Catholic prelates in America. He was associated with St. Patrick's Cathedral. He is, again, a ranking American cardinal in New York City. He requested, well, Linda wanted to meet with him, and he made it very clear that that was just fine with him. And they met a number of times. He didn't seem... he didn't tell her she was crazy or anything or going to hell. He was fascinated by it. and they developed a rather extraordinary rapport. There are many other parts of the story, but it's the real deal. It happens, and it happens to real people. Although, of course, the logical mind, especially folks not like you guys or me who have studied this subject coming out of our original interest in the UFO phenomena per se, you know, we're faced with the data. And I think part of our job is, as my sister kind of set the example for me, is to help educate people. And one of the things that I really love about what you do, Jerry, is you're a broadcaster. You know, you could be covering lots of other topics and all kinds of goofy things that people are interested in, more superficial. But you've dedicated your professional life to this. Elaine's been an activist. Is it Greg? Also Greg. Out there in the field trying to make Greg, sense of this and help people understand in, you know, our own ways that this is not, you know, our little fantasy. This is something that is really going on.
Yeah, Peter, I understand you have to go here pretty quickly, but before you do, you've got to set up a date with me to tell me the latest on Rendlesham. When you get back home, if you ever get back home.
It's major, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's speak in the next week or so, because also I haven't even touched on this has been an amazing couple of months for me. Here I am in beautiful Arizona working with some great people. And last month I spent most of the month abroad. I spoke in three different cities in France. I did four television shows there. I spoke at the big Rendlesham Forest Conference. And I even had my very first opportunity to head out to the mysterious, beautiful part of England known as Wiltshire, which is crop circle country, and through my dear friend and colleague Jennifer Stein, who is one of the most knowledgeable people in America on crop circles and a very rational researcher, we spent the day visiting three different formations with one of the great local authorities, and I'll tell you what, it was one of the most exciting days I've had in years. Fascinating. So yeah, plenty to talk about on the next show for sure.
Yeah, we're going to have to. Elaine and Craig, you have any parting comments or questions?
I have some questions for Peter.
Sure.
My understanding is that there's a lot more to the story than we know from Witness. A lot more broke after Witness was published. Is that correct?
Not so much that I'm aware of. After it was published?
Was published. Because there are several things that I had understood about is that the Dave and Dan saga was that they,
well,
it turns out that they were involved in, it was like an official motorcade or something like that.
Everything that I'm aware of, with the exception of, I guess, the odd little postscript, is in that book, fully investigated and published. Yeah. I would say for anybody that's listening and you're new to the subject, if you're interested in reading a book on UFO abduction phenomena as opposed to UFOs per se, I think this is as great a book on a single case, and it is certainly the most important book published on a multiple
witness case. It reads like a really good detective
novel.
They can pick that book
up.
Peter, what's the correct title of that book?
It's Witnessed, the True Story of the Brooklyn Bridge UFO Abductions. And I would also say that, like really most of Bud's books, you can find these books, either a good reader copy or a collector copy, used online. You don't have to, you know, get a brand new book. It's the content that you're after. And it was published in hardcover as well as a mass market paperback, as were Bud's other books. And, build your library for me as a bibliophile and an avid reader. I would also say, if you want to read one of the most unique memoirs that I'm aware of ever published in this country, the book that Bud finished 2 years before he died, well, 3 years before he died, is a book called Art, Life, and UFOs. And it's a memoir about Bud's art, about his life, and about his interest and involvement with UFOs. And it's a heck of a unique American story. He was quite a guy and a very fine writer, and he pulls no punches in the book. It's quite something.
And Elaine, you had experiences with the late, great Bud Hopkins as well. You have any closing comments?
Peter, you're very well spoken.
Thanks. I have somebody, I pay a lot of money to write my scripts for me.
Thanks, okay, Elaine. We're going to take a break, and Peter will...
That's a real compliment, and I appreciate it. And I appreciate all of your hard work over the years as well.
We have Stan Romanek standing by. Interesting fellow and an interesting experience. Scary, really. That's coming up as we continue with our abduction special. I'm Jerry Pippin. Don't go away.
You know, when we pause for a commercial, it's always for somebody who pays the freight, pays the way. Well, I'm going to take time out to talk about somebody who can't pay their way. And that's the stray animals, dogs and cats and other animals, who need your help. And there is a way to help them. Support no-kill animal shelters. It's a gift of life that keeps on giving. These animal shelters are located around the world and maybe in your neighborhood. Animals, they need love. They don't need to be sent someplace and then executed just because they don't have a home. Support the animal shelter that is a no-kill shelter near you. Give them a donation of $10, $25, $50 or more. The money will be well used. The animals will love you for it. So give a gift of love. A gift of life to that stray dog or cat. Our ET abduction special continues. Many times they come in the middle of the night. The terror, the fear is overriding. Those who experience it never forget it.
When I opened up my eyes before I threw that pillow, this thing was standing at the foot of my bed. Do you know what that's like? How did that thing get in my apartment? And it was standing there, just standing there staring at me. These people took me. And they were your classic grays, you know, with the large heads and the big, black, shiny eyes. I don't remember a nose, but they had slits for mouths, long necks, real thin. They were about my size at the time, maybe taller.
And this is our abduction special for the middle of the summer, July 25th, is when the broadcast is live. And we have on our panel Elaine Douglas, and she, of course, has the Abduction Magazine Jars, which is a quarterly email, e-mag, I guess is what we like to call it. And then we have Craig Lang, who's a hypnotherapist really for 15 years or so, and active in MUFON as well. And in a minute, we're going to, you just heard that little bumper, as we call it in the business, and it was actually a woman testifying, and some other people, about their abduction experiences. And in a moment, we're going to have Stan Romanek, who has become quite well known, and he's had an incredible experience, terrifying in many ways. And I'm not trying to put words in his mouth. I'll let him describe it himself. But before we go to Stan out there in Colorado, Elaine, we kind of had you, you were kind of quiet during the last 15 or 20 minutes, so I thought I'd give you a chance to add anything to the show so far, if you feel up to it.
Well, it was very enjoyable listening to Peter.
Yeah, he mentioned... something when we were talking to Peter Robinson, talking about his time that he worked with Bud Hopkins.
One thing that kind of went by us, but as an editor of JARS, the magazine, a lot of these experiences have had UFO sightings, but not always. I've always found that puzzling. Maybe they just don't remember it.
That's correct. Not all abductees have had a UFO sighting.
And so it's a little tough. Craig, you had a lot of questions for Peter, and we didn't have enough time to really go through all of them. You have anything to say before we get to Stan?
The comment or question or whatever that I had, I know several people who have done some independent digging on the whole Brooklyn Bridge abductions thing, and there's a lot of other writings and investigative notes outside of what Bud Hopkins wrote. And I don't know that much about it, you know, frankly. I have not followed the case that closely.
What's one of your questions that you have?
That's where I'm headed. Is that apparently there was some more that had happened in apparently Linda's relationship with Cardinal O'Connor was, who initiated that and things like that. I'm just really curious about the truth behind some of that.
Well, you've probably heard that Linda had many run-ins with either intelligence officers or police.
Yeah, right.
Picked her up for interrogations and things like that and got very involved in her case. Plus, of course, the big deal is that somebody named Cuellar, a UN official, was ostensibly parked under a nearby bridge and witnessed with him and his bodyguards.
Perez de Cuellar, right. He was Secretary General at the time.
Right. So the case, it's quite a deal.
As Stan Romanek will tell us here in a moment, when you come out and make public statements like this, there's always people taking pot shots at you.
Yeah, right.
And Linda is not without some of those, including Bud's ex-wife. But at the same time, I'm inclined to take people at their word and at what they say, unless proven otherwise. I think it's much easier to have an open mind than it is to be a skeptic from the beginning. And Stan Romanek's story got me going a long time ago, and I couldn't track him down for some reason, but I found several people who knew him. In fact, did a show, and broadcasters are famous for this. I did a show with people who knew him because I couldn't find Stan at the time. But we found him tonight. And Stan, how are you?
I'm good. I'm doing really good.
Good. So you had a little tragedy there, and we all are familiar with, but it kind of hit personally there in Aurora. One of your friends was shot, right?
Exactly. Our close friend Heidi, her daughter was at the movie theater when the gunman came and started opening fire, and she wasn't actually shot. She was hit by shrapnel from, apparently what happened is this crazy guy took pieces of metal and all kinds of other stuff and taped it around this smoke grenade, so when the smoke grenade went off, it acted as a regular grenade, and it literally opened her up like a gutted fish. And luckily, she, there were people there to save her and, get her to the hospital right away.
Uh-huh.
But she's still in critical condition.
Well, let's hope for the best, and I'm sure all of our positive vibes are going that way for all of those people involved in that. Let's get to the subject at hand for a minute, Stan, and maybe you can tell people exactly from the beginning a little bit about your experiences. When did this start happening?
Well, the main part of my experiences really started with my very first UFO sighting in 2000. But it goes back, like most experiencers, my story goes back to when I was a child. My father was involved in the military. He was in the Air Force. He had top secret clearance and worked at missile bases with ICBM missiles. And there's a story in my family that's been there since 68. I was 5 years old at the time, and my father was stationed at Grand Forks and worked between Grand Forks and Minot, North Dakota, at the missile bases there.
Mm-hmm.
And they had an incident where a UFO came down and armed one of the missiles. Not disarmed, but armed the missile in launch position. And, you know, there's some things that happened after that that I remember as a small child, a very strange woman that kind of followed me throughout my life. And then in 2000, when I saw my first UFO, it just kind of kick-started everything from there. And then 2001, I had my first abduction, and everything went crazy.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that first abduction that you can remember. Were you aware of being abducted originally? Or
absolutely. You know, when you watch television, you know, they always try to get people to think that it's this thing called sleep paralysis. But the trouble with that scenario, number one, sleep paralysis is fairly rare. You almost have to be narcoleptic to have it. Number two, it doesn't account for, you know, cases like Betty and Barney Hill, Travis Walton, Snowflake, Arizona. In my case, I was completely awake when it happened. I wasn't asleep at all. In fact, I remembered most everything. Funny thing is, when you get that traumatized, you convince yourself that it's something other than it is. And I convinced myself it was some kind of bizarre nightmare until I got up the next morning and there was all kinds of evidence. And then my world came crashing down rather quickly.
Yeah, now tell our audience a little bit about, you said traumatized, so it wasn't a pleasant experience.
Well, it wasn't, you know, with anything that is, you know, where society forces us to, you know, only believe in certain things, and believing in UFOs and aliens is not one of them, at least not for me. I was a complete skeptic. And when my experiences happened, it was very, very hard for me to come to terms with that. I mean, I've got this theory. There are two different types of reality. There's the reality that we were taught by society, and then there's the true reality that is more amazing than we could ever imagine. And getting to that second reality is pretty tough for a lot of people. And yes, my experiences were scary in the fact that I was dealing with beings that were not from this planet. Were they as horrible as some? No. You hear all kinds of horrible stories about the abduction experience. Yes, they took me against my will. Yes, they did experiments on me, but they seemed to, whoever these particular beings were, seemed to be very concerned about my mental health, about my, you know, they didn't want me to be in pain. They didn't want me to, you know, which sometimes you hear. You know, I've heard different scenarios. So to me, it seems like there must be different things here with different agendas. Some just don't care and some do.
Now, when you talk about they did things to you, experiments, what kind of things?
Well, when I was taken, I was literally woken up in the middle of the actually it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and there was a knock at the door, which is not typical of the abduction phenomena. And there were three beings at the door that I thought were small. Yeah, I thought they were just teenagers messing around until I got close and realized that, no, they weren't masks, no, they weren't costumes. And, you know, the experiments are...
I mean, were they grays?
They weren't. They weren't your typical aliens that you see on TV. They weren't the typical grays. They had very big heads, like grays do. They were a little bit taller. They were maybe 4 foot some odd inches. Very, very pale, but not gray. And they had hair, but the hair was almost pure white and very sparse. and their eyes were not all black. They had irises, and their irises, and very huge wraparound, very slanted eyes, but their irises were so blue they were almost violet. And I remember the only name I could come up with was possum people, because they have these very long, and even that's not correct, but they have this very long, kind of pointy chin, and a very small mouth and nose at the end of this, you know, toward the end of this chin. And and I remember the way they moved was completely different, too. They were very, how do I explain it? They weren't jerky at all. They were very smooth in their movements. Like they can, like they were able to control their movements a lot better than, and very quick also.
But did they say anything?
They, not like you or I, and it's very hard for me to explain, because it's almost like trying to explain the color red to somebody that's blind and somebody that's never seen the color red before, but. You know, it's like a thought would pop into your head, and that's when I realized that, yeah, that's how they communicated.
So and they were there at the door. Did they carry
they
you out,
the
command that you go with them, or did they come in, or
well,
what?
Well, see, that's the thing about this whole situation. Oddly, I was screaming internally because I was terrified that no sound would come out of my mouth. My sister had already opened the door, and there were these people standing outside, and the one in the middle came in, and we lived in a second-story apartment, came in and grabbed my wrist, and they started leading me out to the balcony. And right as we got to the sliding glass door, they were opening the sliding glass door. The sliding glass door was open. I don't really remember. I must have been frightened enough that I snapped out of whatever trance I was in, and I remember picking up the being that was next to me, and I was literally going to throw him off the balcony. And I remember feeling a light tap on the back of my head, and I woke up somewhere else. I woke up in, well...
So you were out and you didn't remember after you picked the being up. They intervened by tapping you on the head or something like that. Is that right?
That's correct. And it wasn't like they hit me on the head. It was like, I don't know, I can't tell you. It was like...
They took control of you.
They took control, exactly. Now, when I woke up, oddly, I was stuck to a wall, and not glued, not chained, but almost like if you were to go on one of those centrifugal force rides at the amusement park.
Okay.
And I remember looking off to my side, and there were, it almost looked like quarter-sized copper pieces embedded in this wall, and every foot or so. And I remember one of the beings when I came to. And I couldn't figure out how I could move my head and my hands a little bit to look around, but I just couldn't break free of whatever this was. And I couldn't figure out how this being was still able to walk around, and I couldn't. And I remember this whatever it was came up and touched a lit panel on the wall, and it released me. And every time I had a thought, every time I had a fear, a thought would fill my head. It's like, oh my God, where are you from? And then all of a sudden these symbols would fill my head. It's like, how'd you get here? You know, these symbols would fill my head. It was really crazy. And I remember they turned me around, and one of the other beings had a box hanging from a strap on his shoulder. And it looked like it was lit internally with a tube coming out the end. And at the end of this tube, for lack of a better description, looked like it had a melon ball or some kind of scooping device. And they turned me around and they started, I think, taking skin samples off my back, which was absolutely excruciating. And again, they must have sensed my pain, and I woke up in the middle of the room on a table. And there was no freestanding furniture in this room, and there were no corners. Everything was rounded. It was almost like the table or the benches or whatever was in there was literally formed out of the floor of this room or the wall of the room.
Was it cold in there?
I don't remember.
Any feeling, huh?
I don't know. I remember feeling, but I don't remember it being cold and or warm. But I do remember the smells. I vividly remember the smells and the lighting. The lighting was really bizarre. Like, you know those newer European cars that have the bluish headlights? I always have anxiety attacks when I see those cars coming down the road, because that's kind of what it reminds me of, that lighting, that bluish lighting. And I remember I was looking around to see if there was a source for the lighting, and I couldn't find any source. It was just there. Very strange.
And then they did several things to you while you were on the table, or did you get up?
They did. You know, when I was sitting on the table, one of the beings was standing there in front of me, and I was, I don't know if I was groggy from whatever it was that they did or if I was just more calmed down, but the being leaned forward, and literally an explosion of thought filled my head and knocked me over. And at that point, I realized that whatever these things were, they were so much more advanced than we are. We communicate linearly. We communicate word after word, sentence after sentence. It's kind of archaic and slow. These beings almost seem to have the ability to, it's an extrasensory ability. They communicate telepathically, whatever that is, like almost like having a radio transceiver and, you know, emitter in their heads, and they can communicate what I've experienced, large volumes of information in just a thought. And so that being said, apparently they were trying to communicate with me, and it didn't work out very well. And I remember this creature stepping back and turning his head sideways like, oh, you poor pathetic little thing, let's do this again. And then symbol after symbol, vision after vision just kind of filled my head, bam, bam, bam. And then I woke up in my bed that next morning, 8 o'clock, trying to convince myself it was some kind of horrible, bizarre nightmare.
And when you woke up in your bed, had you felt like you had a good night's sleep or been through hell?
No, I was still very tired. Oddly, the night before, I was at work, and I was managing a store, and I closed my store, and people came running back and said, there's a UFO. I mean, there's something above your work. And I went outside, and there's this UFO above my work. This was during rush hour with lots of people to see this thing. And then that next morning I was taken. But I was going to tell my sister that, I had this really weird dream, and before I had a chance to, I got up to make some coffee or something, didn't have a shirt on, and my sister goes, what in the heck happened to your back? And then it came all flooding back, and I fell apart. I was hysterical pretty much.
We're talking with Stan Romanek, and in addition to that, we have Elaine Douglas with us on the panel, and also Craig Lang. And Elaine and Craig, in a minute, will give you a chance to ask questions and make statements. And Stan, you certainly have the floor, so we'll let you talk about anything you want to. But I would be remiss if I didn't go to some of the phone callers. And
sure.
some of these phone callers have questions about Stan, and some of them have a statement or two to make, and so we'll just kind of bounce around here, okay? Yeah, 843 is the area code. How are you?
How you doing, sir? My name's Eric. I used to be in the Air Force. I'm also a firefighter EMT. I had a story for y'all. When I was about 5 years old, I lived with my mom in an apartment in Chattanooga, and it was a second-floor apartment. I used to have problems in the middle of the night. Something scared me. And my mom actually stayed up studying in college, so trying to move the story along. She let me sleep in her bedroom because I was scared and terrified of something of mine. Well, for some reason, I knew I had to stay awake. Otherwise, I wouldn't be able to tell somebody or say anything. And in the middle of the night, I was staying awake. I guess it was maybe 3 a.m. And I saw this being. It had a bright white light coming through the window, and it was standing inside the room, but I never saw it come in the window. And I couldn't see its face, but I could tell that it was like a gray being with bright white behind it, small, maybe 3 foot tall. It when I tried to look at its face, all I could see was like a ram's head. And I used to watch National Geographic. I used to see the rams on TV, butting heads in the beginning of the show. So I assume that's why that image came to mind. But anyways, it really terrified me. I screamed loud as I ever, you know, as possible. I got to the back of the head of the bed screaming. It seemed like for a long time, but finally my mom came in and it was gone. And she was terrified when I told her about it. She thought I saw something, you know, in the closet, but she believed me. And ever since, you know, that, to this day, I don't sleep well at night. But I've never had any experience with that, but I have seen UFOs.
Have you had any more experiences?
Just seeing UFOs occasionally. Once every 3 or 4 years, I'll see a UFO.
Mm-hmm. Stan, Elaine, or Craig, you have any questions or comments?
Caller, what's your first name?
Go ahead, Elaine.
Eric?
What?
My name's Eric.
Eric.
Okay.
I just want to say, Eric, that I really feel for you, what you've said, what you've described as such a young child to be having this tremendously shocking experience. And I'm very, my heart goes out to you, really. I can feel that this was a traumatic experience and that it's still haunting you. And as you stated, that you, having still have trouble sleeping at night. And again, my heart really goes out to you. I don't know if you feel that you would like to get to the bottom of this, but if you ever did, hypnosis is something you might try.
Yeah.
It would cause you to remember more, Eric. I don't know if you want to remember more.
Eric and Stan, both of you can answer this. Do you guys want to remember more, or do you think you remembered enough?
I'm the type of person, ever since that day, and ever since I seen my first UFO and then I remembered that account, my mom verified that it did indeed happen and she believed me. I've always wanted to see its face, you know, see what I couldn't see, what my mind was blocking me from seeing. I want to see its face. I've always been interested, and I have to know the truth. So UFOs have actually become one of my biggest hobbies, you know, secretly.
Geographically, whereabouts do you live?
I live in South Carolina.
I'm sorry? South Carolina?
Currently South Carolina. This incident with the experience happened in Chattanooga, Tennessee.
Okay.
Guys, before we go any further, his mother, Elena Daniels, wrote me at the top of the show, and she's had experiences, so this thing goes in the family. Stan, have you had anybody else in your family have these experiences?
Absolutely. Oddly, you know, they say it runs in families, especially bloodlines. In my case, I have stepchildren, and pretty much everybody has had experiences. And, you know, you talk about the ram's head, you know, that could be, you know, implanted memories, because sometimes these beings don't want you to remember what they look like. They don't want you to see what they look like for whatever reason. And, you know, talking about not being able to sleep, I went through that for a good 5 years. My stepson also had experiences, and my stepdaughters had experiences. And all of them sleep with, you know, the lights on even now. And my stepson, you know, my stepdaughters are twins, and they're 23, and my stepson's 19. And they have tons of pillows. And interestingly enough, their closets, they take the doors off their closets. They don't like having closets with doors on them. And they will stuff things in the closet like a dresser with a TV so nothing can get to them. And that's just part of going through this.
It's been 25 years for me, and I still don't sleep well at night until it hits 4:30 or 5 in the morning a lot of times. And eventually my job just kind of accommodate that when I'm, you know, on duty. But I sleep with an assault rifle next to my bed ready. And I've never had another experience that I know of something actually strange happening once I screamed at it when I was 5, so terrified-like, other than seeing a UFO every 5 years maybe. And it's always a different one. It's kind of weird.
How old are you now, Eric?
Just turned 30 last December, yeah.
Okay. Craig?
I can tell you an assault rifle or any kind of gun won't help. I've tried it.
Yeah.
I've tried everything. It doesn't make a difference.
Yeah, it would be. I think you'd, Eric, I think you'd, this is Craig, I think you'd find that you might, understanding, you might find a lot more peace.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And Stan, are you getting any peace these days?
I am. Honestly, I've come to terms with what's going on. And that is the first step. Because once, you know, people are afraid of what they don't understand. And once they start getting a grasp of what's really going on and they can look outside the box, I'm in amazement now. I mean, I realize that there really is more than just us out there. Some of them are good, some of them are bad, but you know, still there's stuff out there, and it's wonderful. To me, it's wonderful. And you know, what's interesting, when you are afraid, it seems like, you know, more things happen. I don't know if there's certain types that feed off that fear. I'm not exactly sure, but once you get over the fear, a lot of the stuff just goes away. I don't know what.
Yeah, I found that. I found that.
Yeah,
Stan, I have a question for you.
Okay.
Stan, do you want to tell us what this two matters? One is about the film that you took what you believe to be an alien in the window of your house, and the other is your political activities in the city of Denver, I believe.
Sure. The thing in the window started out as what we thought was a peeping Tom. I got married and moved to Nebraska to be with my wife and her kids. She couldn't bring her kids out of Nebraska, and we're having a long-distance relationship over the Internet. We met on the Internet. Became close friends and dated for a couple of years. And I had already started having things happen. And we thought moving somewhere else would make a difference.
Yeah.
Which, moving to the Alaska in the middle of nowhere really doesn't help. But we thought we had a peeping Tom. I have twin stepdaughters, gorgeous kids. They were young teens at the time, and I was watching TV, and I got up to go get a drink of water, and I see what looked like somebody looking in the window, and then they ducked down. It's like, holy crap. This went on literally for about 3 months. The cops got involved. All the neighbors know about it. It got so bad that we set traps outside underneath the windows, like sticks or anything we could think of to make noise, and had a bat by the door. You know, so I'd run out and try to get this guy. Nothing ever worked. One of the researchers involved in my case said, hey, Stan, next time you see movement, go get your camera. It has a night shot on it, your video camera. Point it toward that window and maybe you can catch this guy. Well, that's exactly what I did. And what I captured, well, I looked, I saw that I captured something because its head popped down. I was hiding in the bathroom. And when I looked outside, I thought what I saw was a kid running toward the backyard until it turned around and looked at me, and it scared the living Jesus out of me. And then when I looked on the video, it's like, holy crap. I mean, could this be some guy with a mask? Could it be, you know, there's always a possibility. But what I saw, I know what I saw. And so then you're talking about my political activity. This video, I'm an international best-selling author about the subject. So, and I do speaking engagements. And one of the researchers involved in my case was heavily into politics in Colorado. He's ex-Naval Intelligence, and he had a friend that really didn't believe in this stuff, so he said, hey, you got to go to his talk. Well, he was so impressed, but he still didn't believe. He said, if UFOs were real, the government would let people know about it. That's how naive he was. And so we had to set him straight. And when we showed him what was really going on, he was irate. This man was just so upset. And so he started what is known as the Denver Extraterrestrial Initiative, which was a grassroots campaign to start getting people ready for contact and get people ready, you know, to...
Oh, yeah, I've heard of it. I know about that. I know of it, yeah.
Yeah, it was a way to have full disclosure. It almost made it. It almost got voted in to, you know, the bill was almost voted in.
But yeah, it was pretty close. You got a lot of votes. I remember that.
Yep. And all because of, you know, coming to my talk and seeing the evidence. And they used a little bit of footage to show when they had a press release. They showed that alien in the window. Oddly, shortly after that, somebody broke in and stole my UFO file in the disc with that video on it and leaked it all over the internet. So, you know, we were forced to come out about it, and that's how it started.
Okay, Lorraine, I think that's a pretty good explanation, don't you?
Oh, yeah, I do.
Okay, Craig, you got anything else to say? Eric, are you still there?
I've got a zillion.
Yes,
I talked with you briefly at one of the UFO conferences. You might or might not remember it. It was quite a few years ago when they were out in Denver. But yeah, I think we met briefly then. But you know, it's the only time we've ever, you know, that you and I have ever met. But I have a zillion questions, probably offline. But a lot of the questions I have tend to be kind of how much you remember. I think you worked with Deborah Lindemann, is that correct?
I started out with Deborah Lindemann until something strange happened. And it scared her to the point where she brought me out of the regression and had a hard time with dealing with my case, it seemed like. And then we were introduced to Dr. Leo Sprinkle, and he kind of has been my hypnotherapist ever since.
Okay.
What happened,
so
Stan, in the regression that scared Deborah so much?
Well, people who have been regressed know that it's not like what they show you on TV. They can't control your mind. They can't make you balk like a chicken unless you want to. It's like going into a deep daydream. This was a little bit different. This last regression I had with Deborah Lindemann was different because I thought I fell asleep. And when I woke up, you know, I have all these regressions. Everything's always filmed. There's always people there to make sure everything's safe because I've been through so much and so much stuff happens. And, you know, Deborah says, you know, I can't do this right now. I can't do this right now. And I asked my wife what happened. She said, well, your mannerisms changed. Your voice changed. The way you were acting changed. And it was so much so that I became a different person. And so Deborah didn't really know how to handle it, apparently, and brought me out of it right away.
Sounds like you were taken over by another personality.
Possibly.
Eric, have you ever thought about having hypnotherapy? Regression therapy to find out a little bit more about it, and your mother's had experiences. Have you guys ever talked about that?
We have. For the longest I thought about it, I was against it. But the more I want to know what that thing looked like that I see in my room as a child, I really want to see what it looked like. So I am open to it. I have thought about it recently.
Eric,
okay.
Maybe
you can contact Craig later.
He's
got a website, and we'll plug that here at the end. You got any closing comments before I go on?
Yes, I do. Eric?
Yes, ma'am.
what was the time frame? You say that you were alone in your mother's bedroom, and then the next that, and I also heard you say that your mother came back, and you told her what happened, and she became very alarmed. But how long of a period of time was, if you know, you may not really know. How old were you when this happened, Eric?
I was actually five years old at the time.
It would be hard to tell. You don't have any sense of the length of time from when you first saw this apparition until your mother got there.
It seemed like minutes, but it probably wasn't no more than 30 seconds. And I do remember the intense screaming at the top of my lungs, like I was about to be murdered. It was just the most. That's how I remember something from 5 years old. It was so intense. So, then when my mom got in there, I repeated.
So it was your screaming.
It was real.
So it was your screaming that brought your mother into the bedroom?
Yes.
I see. All right.
Okay, Eric, thanks for calling in. And stay in touch. And we appreciate your input.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Stan, he wants to see the face. Can you see the face?
Oh, yeah. What I can remember almost everything. For whatever reason, whatever I am going through, there are differences, a little bit of differences. They don't really shut me off like most of the people that I've talked to that have had experiences. And what really makes this case so different is the fact that most everything that happens with multitudes of people around. So I'm kind of the lucky ones because I don't have to explain myself through most of this stuff. And in fact, if it was happening to me and there was nobody around, I probably wouldn't tell anybody because, you know, how am I going to prove it anyhow?
Mm-hmm. Now, you've been working on a documentary. Is that ready to be released?
It's J3 Films is doing a documentary about me. They have already finished filming it. It should be out in theaters or wherever it is that they're, I think, in theaters, probably the end of summer, beginning of fall. But I'm not in control of that. They are.
And have you written a book?
I have. I've written 3 books now. My wife has written one.
Right. I was familiar with her book and one of your books, but I didn't know it was 3. Let's plug them.
Yep. Well, there's my first book, the one that's an international best-selling book, is called Messages. And then I wrote Answers is my last book. In the middle are some regression transcripts with Dr. Leo Sprinkle. You know, I talked about earlier how something changed when I did the regressions. Well, it changed with Dr. Leo Sprinkle, and he ran with it and let it happen, which is absolutely amazing. And, you know, the first book, I kind of give you what happened to me in chronological order. Answers, I tell you what I've learned and what I've learned about the human race and how the human race they don't know who they really are. They don't know the amazing abilities they have. And, you know, that there is much more out there, you know, than we could ever imagine.
Craig and Elaine, let's have you two join in. And I know you have more questions for Stan and statements.
Stan, what do you remember do you have any memories now of when you did that personality shift, when you started, I'm going to use the word channel, I'm not sure if that's the right word or not, but do you have any memories of that?
I don't. Luckily, it got so intense that, you know, we had scientists and physicists and all these amazing people during these events, and they'd ask questions and get these amazing answers, you know, that were just outrageous. And I remember nothing. If it wasn't for the fact that they videotaped them, I wouldn't believe it. I just wouldn't believe it. But, you know, you're sitting there watching the video as a third person going, that's not me, that's something else.
Mm-hmm.
And it is what it is. I mean,
Stan, you're such a mild-mannered guy normally. Would this personality shift? Were you violent?
No, I was. Here's the thing. I'm very dyslexic. I didn't do very well in school, and whatever this thing is extremely intelligent. And if you talk to, you know, the physicists and the scientists and, you know, the psychologists that were there, they all say the same thing. They say that whatever this is, they feel like kindergarten students. And, you know, it talks about concepts that, you know, even the people that were there didn't really understand. And it's just very fascinating. And I put it in my second book called The Orion Regressions.
Yeah, Elaine, I think you had something to say.
Yeah, Stan, could you expand a little bit on the title of your book, Messages from Whom to Whom, Messages About What?
Every abductee, every experiencer gets messages to give to people. You know, like, you know, if you don't stop what you're doing, you're going to destroy the planet. That's pretty typical.
Mm-hmm.
Most experiencers are meant to feel special, that they are chosen for whatever reason.
Right.
Including me.
Yeah.
You know, there's always these scenarios, and they always have messages to give to people. You know, going through this journey, a lot of people will ask me, if you had a magic button, would you go back and change it so it never happened? And I got to tell you, in the beginning, I would have said yes. Now, no way. I'd do it over again for sure, because I'm a better person for it. I've learned exponentially. I understand things that most people didn't even know existed. And so, you know, it's all just part of the process. It's part of the journey, I guess.
Again, what are the messages?
Well, the message is, the biggest message is, it's time for us to grow up. It's time for us to stop being controlled and understand that if we want to, you know, find the answers, we have to look within ourselves.
Being controlled by?
By, you know, the governments, the global elite, the whatever. You know, there's a small amount of them and a large amount of us. Stop believing everything you see on TV. Stop, you know, falling for the fear thing and wake up. It's time to wake up.
Who's telling you those messages?
Well, the whoever has taken me.
Okay.
The visitors, the aliens, the whatever.
Okay. We're almost out of time. This has been an intriguing show, and especially the last hour with you, Stan. And we're going to have you back on one of these days. But I have to ask, has the contact stopped, or do you still feel like you're getting messages and maybe even abducted?
Absolutely. Not really necessarily in a bad way, but they show up all the time, again, usually when people are around. I've done three talks, and the last three talks I've done, we've had night watches, and every single one of those, there have been massive UFO sightings. The last one was in Florida, and the Air Force actually got involved. So,
how did the Air Force get involved?
You have any closing comments, and then I'll go to Elaine, and then we'll let Stan wrap it up.
I'm just go ahead, Elaine. I'm just busy processing here. I'm just kind of. I'm not familiar enough with Stan's, you know, with the whole story of Stan's to ask a lot of real credible questions at this point. So go ahead, Elaine.
Stan, yeah. Thanks, Gray. Stan, how did the Air Force get involved?
Well, we were on our way to a Skywatch when a rather large glowing orange UFO came above us, took off, and then swooped back around and hovered above us again. And apparently it was picked up by radar, because the next morning we saw on the local news that the Air Force picked up a UFO, and there were lots and lots of people that saw this thing.
The Air Force
picked up on radar. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I see. Okay.
And they must have, you know, scrambled some jets. And we had another incident like that with Phoenix MUFON, with Jim Mann taking a bunch of people up to a night watch up there, and we were followed by a mile-long cylinder UFO, and you can see all the witness reports online if you want to.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Dan.
You bet.
Okay, so, now, I would love... Are you going to be at this MUFON conference, Dan?
I'm going to be at the MUFON conference. I'm going to be at is going to be in October up in Pennsylvania.
Oh, okay. All right. So you won't be at the international one then? Huh?
No, I won't be at the international one. I don't really have time.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay, Stan. Is October your next appearance?
My next appearance is this weekend in Southwest Colorado at the San Luis Valley. I'm doing a conference there. If people want to learn about it, they can go to my website, www.stanromnick.com. We've got things coming up all the time. We're constantly on the move. It looks pretty good. I'm going to be doing a college lecture tour, and then I'm going to be doing a European tour at the beginning of next year, actually. So I'm going to be busy.
Okay, Craig Ling, your website is?
www.craigrlang.com is my hypnotherapy practice, and then my book is www.thecosmicbridge.com.
And what's next on your agenda?
For me?
Yeah,
I'm going to be doing a lot. I'm doing a number of working with several different MUFON chapters in the next little while. We're doing regressions this weekend. I'm going down to Iowa to work on some close encounter cases down there, working with Bev Trout. And then I'm at the MUFON conference. I'm doing some regressions there with people. And then also I'm going to be down in Indiana working with the Indiana MUFON folks, doing some whole bunch
Elaine,
of
Elaine Douglas, I know you're not taking it easy out there in Utah. Do you got something going on you want to tell us about?
That I want to tell you about. Well, I'm busy connecting the dots. Jerry.
Well, we appreciate you coming on, all three of you, and everybody that's participated in the show. It's been a terrific and very fast 3 hours.
Yeah, really.
Thanks very much, all of you, and we will be doing another abduction special in the early fall.
This pleasure,
program
Jerry.
Is. Yeah, thank you very much. This program.
My pleasure.
Is a labor of love for me, and I appreciate everybody and Inception Radio Network for giving us the time. And check out further information there, as well as our website, jerrypippin.com. Until next time, this is Jerry Pippin. Thank you for listening, everyone. Cheers.